Dramatised events. Characters and letters in this series were inspired by true stories from known historical facts and archive. Every family has secrets, and family dynasties surely have more secrets than most. How exactly does generation after generation seemingly have the Midas touch, conquering markets around the globe from Egypt to China? But then you find yourself in a crisis. Not because you've had one too many tastings of your beloved product, Irish whiskey, and nor have you been sleeping on the job, but because things are truly outside of your control. Wars, prohibition, bootleggers. So what would you do? Do you pour a stiff drink of whiskey and go it alone, fearlessly, just like your ancestors? Or do you share your business and the family secrets that have been entrusted to you if it means a chance of survival? This is the story of three families who found themselves in this position. A story of Irish whiskey, how three families saved it from extinction.
I was very small when the first meeting was held here at Turin, and I was told to keep things very secret. And in fact, I don't think they trusted me, so I was told very little.
The year was 1966, and Irish whiskey was on its knees, about to go out of business after 200 years of economic and cultural success. In one last roll of the dice, the three main whiskey families, Jameson, Powers, and Murphy's, came together to see if their family legacies could be saved by joining forces after centuries of rivalry.
But I do remember people arriving in smart cars, which we weren't used to, and them coming into the hallway and me peeping downstairs.
This secret meeting took place in Turin House in Capaquin, County Waterford, hosted by Shane Jemison. His daughter, Andrea Jemison, remembers the meeting at her home, a vast 17th-century Italian-style villa where the Jemison family continues to live.
It was all very exciting and hush-hush, but I knew deep down that it was very important. Even though I was tiny, I took it very seriously.
There was definitely a tension. And, I mean, as children, we'd always ask, who's coming, who's coming? But we were never really told. It was business.
Shane Jemison's eldest daughter, Kristen, also remembers the meeting.
Anybody who came to the front door, my mother met and took them straight to the dining room.
Hello, Mrs. Jemison. I'm Frank O'Reilly from Powers. Thank you for having us.
A pleasure.
Pleased to meet you, Mrs. Jemison. I'm Norbert Murphy, Cork Distilleries Company.
Welcome. Please come in.
Hello, Dee Dee. Good to see you again.
And you too, Alec.
Please, take a seat. We thought you'd like a bite to eat. Dee Dee, I might even put on a little music, just to keep little ears at the door busy.
I think, looking back, of course, they didn't want any talk or anybody to know outside the circle what was going on. And I'm sure that's why Turin was chosen, because it's right out in the country. I can remember seeing the places set in the dining room with a pad and pencil beside it, as for a meeting, but I soon really realised that there was something very important going on.
The late John Ryan, the great-great-great-grandnephew of James Power, who founded Power's Whiskey, was asked in an interview 2 years before his passing about the meeting that took place in Turin House, that his father, John Ryan, amongst others, were in attendance.
Sadly, the 20th century, the early part of the 20th century, was an economic disaster for Irish whiskey. It was quite clear by the mid-1950s that if Irish whiskey was going to have a worthwhile future, it was going to have to dig a hole and bury the hatchet of competition, because these three companies were spending all of their time and effort and energy and money and manpower on competing with each other in the domestic market and didn't have any time or energy or money left over for exports. And the future obviously lay in exports.
By the time of the Turin House meeting in 1966, less than 1% of the Irish whisky industry remained, and their demise seemed inevitable. However, Frank O'Reilly, chairman of Powers, thought he might have found a solution. But he knew it would be a hard sell, and even then, it might not work.
It's all very well, Frank, for you to throw out phrases and words like think outside the box, innovate, modernise. But as you know, we adopted modern technology, the coffee still, and our customers didn't like the flavour profile it produced. They preferred our whiskey distilled the traditional way, the slow way.
I'm not arguing on that point, but we have to change our thinking. Let go or at least loosen our ties to the past. That is, if you desire to have a future different from the present.
You lads aren't going to get me on board.
Norbert, none of us know exactly where Frank is going with all this, so let's give him a chance.
We have to look fear in the face and do the very things we fear most.
And in times like this, we might think it's harder than ever to be brave. But then I think back to what John Jemison I did to start his business, the first Jemison distillery. Only someone without fear would dream to do what John Jemison did.
From Scotland, John Jemison arrived in Dublin in 1780. In Dublin, his eyes were open to opportunity all around him, especially in the growing area of distilling.
And about the 1770s, Dublin was somewhere you wanted to be. It was thriving. It was the second city of the British Empire.
Carol Quinn, archivist, Irish Distillers, describes why Georgian Dublin would have been attractive to someone like John Jemison.
We're talking the Georgian period here. We're talking the beginning of the beautiful plazas, the squares, the houses.
To my dearest Margaret, I arrived in Dublin yesterday to what the Irish refer to as a soft day, a light but unrelenting drizzle. What a thriving, bustling, cosmopolitan city this is. The homes which line the wide streets are graceful enough to rival high society London. My darling, how you would admire the shop windows, with luxuries from four corners of the globe. This is a magnificent city of great prosperity and possibilities. I came across a distillery at Bow Street, and its potential for development is exhilarating. I will be counting the days until you and the children join me. Your devoted husband, John.
The shops that he sees going around Dublin, that he just writes back home, he's astounded by it. And it was this that would have attracted John Jemison to the city of Dublin. He was somebody with great ambition, both for himself and for his family. He understood whisky making. He was from an area that was famous for its whisky making. But in Dublin, he saw opportunity. And around 1780, for the first time, distilleries began to be licensed. It was the beginning, really, of the modern period.
Norbert, Frank, a glass of Jemison?
Sure. I couldn't say no to someone whose family fought off pirates and monsters to defend his homeland, because that's the type of fighting spirit we're going to need.
Let me pour it for you. Definitely no ice, Frank.
At least we can agree on one thing.
To fearlessness.
To fearlessness.
Frank, you called this meeting, so the floor is yours.
I've brought us all together because we're all in the same boat. We're ultimately facing the demise of Irish whisky, of our business, our livelihoods, and that of our workers. And I know that's hard to say out loud. So I have a plan, a proposal. And it's a bold one, and Powers has always been seen as bold. And we're not about to change that on my watch. But all I need from you right now is to stay open-minded, to think back to the type of obstacles your distilleries have overcome, because in there lies the secret in how we save Irish whiskey. I think we've all firmly established that over each of our company's histories, we have developed not just skills as distillers, but certain traits that saw us through tough times, that allowed us to survive 200-odd years.
We need to acknowledge the elephant in the room, Frank. We all know why we're here.
Norbert was very reluctant, I think, to join the merger.
Frank O'Reilly's son, Charles, who also worked in the business with his father, remembers his dealings with Mr. Norbert.
The only person he would speak to is my father. So in the early days of the meetings, he wouldn't attend any meetings. My father would meet him separately and try and cajole him and bring him up to date with progress. And my father got on very well with him. They'd meet in the strangest places, in pubs and hotels and all sorts of places. And Norbert would always be driven in a chauffeur-driven Morris Minor, which was about, I don't know, at that stage, must have been 30 or 40 years old. So he was a great character, and he was very much the ruler of Cork Distillers. He was very much the decision maker.
I'm not sure what elephant you're referring to, Mr. Norbert, but I'd like to hear from Frank.
We each want the same thing, to save Irish whiskey from extinction. But if we keep going it alone, we will all fail. There's nothing surer. If we have any chance of surviving in this economic climate, then we must come together. We are stronger together. That's it. That's what the solution is.
Irish Distillers was the last roll of the dice for these distilleries. It really, really was. They were operating on fumes. You know, they were down to a skeleton staff. They couldn't invest in new equipment. They couldn't do the marketing that was needed. So it really is a moment of extreme stress and extreme crisis. And that's what leads to the formation of Irish Distillers. This wasn't an easy thing, this coming together of the three companies. And I think without Frank O'Reilly of Powers, that merger would never have happened, because he was a man of great personal integrity, and he was implicitly trusted by both Jameson and the Cork Distilleries Company. And he was, in fact, the bridge between the two, because there was distrust.
It was a battle to save Irish whiskey.
Michael Carr, Powers ambassador.
And they didn't look on it as saving Powers. The families faded into background. This was a united front, a battle to save Irish whiskey.
He always said he had a great sense of duty.
Frank O'Reilly's daughter, Olivia, explains how her father approached this merger.
So everything he did was thinking of not just the industry, but Ireland as a whole. People would often make the remark, oh, where's your dad? We need him to sort this lot out. A people person, you know. He had this very broad vision of where he could imagine. And because he had travelled so much as a young man after Trinity, the war, he'd seen so much.
He was a man of just absolute integrity. And I think all of the others recognise that. And they recognise that he would put the needs, the wider needs of the company, before maybe his own personal interests, which he did many, many times. And as well as a great integrity, from talking to people now who knew him, he seems to be a man of great personal warmth. And I think that's a legacy that he gave to Irish Distillers, is a nice way of doing business, you know. It seems almost trite to say it, but just be nice to people, you know, behave decently. And it's a much more pleasant working day, I can tell you, when that is the ethos. And I think that is a legacy from Frank O'Reilly.
The late John Ryan of Powers, in one of his last interviews before his passing, described the reaction to the merger.
when it was announced in 1966, in March 1966, frankly, they kept the secret extremely well, and it came as a complete surprise to the market of Ireland, to the stock market, and to the marketplace for whiskey in Ireland. And most people stopped and stepped back and thought about it for a while and came to the conclusion, yes, it's the obvious right thing to do. Why didn't they think of doing it earlier?
I think that decision cannot be underestimated for the impact that it has had on the Irish whiskey category.
Master distiller Brian Nation on why the merger was so important.
At that stage, Irish whiskey category was dead. You had three strong families trying to grow their own brands. And if they didn't have the foresight or the willingness to come together, they probably would have defeated each other and ultimately defeated the Irish whiskey category. So it was a brave decision and probably a tough decision at the time for the three families to come together and amalgamate. But it was the best decision that they ever made. And that's why we're able to sit here now talking about the success of the Irish whiskey category, because if that didn't happen, I don't think there would have been an Irish whiskey category at this stage.
But the decision to come together, while saving Irish whiskey from the brink, wasn't to be the end of their troubles. In fact, the long road back to success was only just beginning. And in the years to come, there would be innumerable obstacles along the way. They had one goal in mind, however: to get back to where they belonged, when, in the 1800s, Irish whiskey ruled the world. They had done it once before, and they wanted to do it again. Join us on the next episode of A Story of Irish Whiskey.
They wanted something that when you went in, your jaw would drop, and you would talk about it.
Can't be the same. Not just another whiskey. We need to be different, distinct.
May I introduce Senator Teddy Roosevelt?
And ultimately, the fall. A Story of Irish Whiskey is produced by LastCastMedia.com for Irish Distillers, with special thanks to our interviewees for their contributions to the series, in particular those at the Middleton and Bow Street Distilleries. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. And for more information on Irish whiskey, go to irishdistillers.ie.